part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part. Fanboy.com.
Here we are.
Yeah, no, sorry. I guess maybe I should have just set up the Zoom because I usually only use Zoom for work. And, you know, I've never really like gone in and like set up a meeting because I always use Skype because it's just, to me, it just always seems simpler. And you never had to pay for anything if you had multiple, you know. So I apologize for frustrating you on this Sunday morning.
Oh, no, I apologize for being a Luddite. And, it's now 12:04, so I think I've been penalized 4 minutes of our interview.
No, that's okay. We can go a little longer if we need to. Our listeners know of our constant frustrations with Skype because we're always not bashing it, but lamenting how much easier it should be to connect with people. Yeah. And it just ends up being kind of like a little bit of a disaster, even for those of us who use it all the time. So I apologize for making you go through that.
Hey, thanks for hanging in there with me, Christian.
No, absolutely. So how do I pronounce your last name? Is it Voger or Voger or?
That's it. Voger, just like that.
Oh, okay. Voger. Okay. I was just, yeah. I always screw up last names and I didn't want to say Voger and then have it be Voger or some, you know, something fancy like that. But
only in French restaurants do I go by Voger.
Or visiting Paris.
Yeah. Marcel Voger.
That's fancy. Now that's fancy.
Yeah.
Well, my name is Christian Horn, and this is the Part-Time Fanboy podcast, which we've finally gotten up on this Sunday morning. We have just passed the Thanksgiving holiday, and like you've heard, I've had a couple of little frustrations with the Skype line, but our guest is Mark Voger. See, I almost went fancy with it automatically, Voger. And he is the author of a new book coming out. Or is it out already, Mark? Or
it's out.
Oh, okay.
It came out last week.
Oh, great. And, so perfect. Like right in time for the like Black Friday deals, right?
Yeah, or the Cyber Monday deal.
Yeah, Cyber Monday. But it's been released by Two Morrows Publishing. And I just want to thank John Morrow for setting this up for me because I love Two Morrows stuff. And when I got the email, the book is called Holly Jolly, Celebrating Christmas Past in Pop Culture. Again, written by Mark Voger. And yeah, no, this is great, but this seems like something a little different for Two Morrows. Like this is actually, I don't know, is usually Two Morrows is sort of like related with comic book stuff, comic book history, stuff like that, or pop culture. And this is a book about Christmas, right? Just in time for the holidays, I guess.
Yeah, they have branched out in recent years. Like, of course, the Two Morrows history is very interesting. It started with in the 90s with a modest fanzine, the Jack Kirby Collector, which is still being published.
Yeah.
And then it turned into this, you know, publishing empire. And through their efforts, they've preserved so much comics history and so much testimony from the people who created comics culture.
Yeah.
But they recently, you know, I would say like in the past, well, they always did little side things. Like they did their Lego thing, and they did a Captain Action book. They've had things that were like peripherally related to comics. But I guess in the past, like 5 years, 6 years, they started branching into retro pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a book in 2015 called Monster Mash, which is all about the monster craze of the 60s.
Yeah.
And then 2 years later, I did a book called Groovy, which is about psychedelia. And they do have a new, relatively new magazine. It's been publishing for more than a year, edited by Michael Urey, titled Retro Fan. And that's all about, you know, the crazy cool culture we grew up with. So yeah, it's not so much outside their wheelhouse anymore. They're not only comics.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's interesting because, I've seen Retrofan because I'm friends with Scott Shaw. And on his Facebook page, I guess I don't know if he does an article in there or draws cartoons. I should know more about that. And he's going to kill me when he hears this. But I know that he does some work for them through that. They've been branching out a little bit more. But this is interesting in that it's a book about our favorite holiday, Christmas. I mean, I guess, pretty much. Or the holiday that drives you crazy every year, right?
Yeah. And it's and it still takes the pop culture approach. It's one of those things where here's a holiday that began as a religious observance.
Yeah.
And millennia ago, you know, and millennii.
Yeah.
And today it's, over the centuries, it morphed into something else. There's kind of two Christmases, hence the bumper sticker, Keep Christ in Christmas, but yeah. it's about baby Jesus in Bethlehem. And it's also about, Santa Claus, candy canes and red nosed reindeers, you know?
Yeah.
So the Holly Jolly doesn't ignore either. It's trying to be like sort of a humorous approach, but it talks about the religious origins. Mm-hmm. I'm a South Jersey Catholic schoolboy.
Yeah.
So a lot of that stuff was beaten into me by the nuns.
Yep. Same here.
And, yeah. Oh, okay. Well, then let's say a rosary, Christian.
Yeah. I may have forgotten how to do that. I'm a lapsed Catholic, I should say. But anyway, go on.
I'm a devout lapsed Catholic. And then, of course, it talks about, how St. Nicholas, legends about him, mm-hmm. sort of turned him into this other thing. And, it was pronounced Sinterklaas by Dutch settlers and then in Manhattan and then the pronunciation got massaged into Santa Claus and, mm-hmm. and then, the poems that sort of built on the Santa Claus mythology until the point where you had, books and then movies, the first Santa Claus movie was made in 1898, which was still in Victorian England at the time.
Made
in England. Yeah.
I did not know that. That's amazing. Yeah, no. So maybe you can clear up a sort of, we weren't having a debate, but we were watching the Kurt Russell thing, Christmas Chronicles on Netflix. I don't know if you've seen that.
No, I haven't seen that.
Oh, it's really good. But they did a sequel this year. So we went back and watched the first one. And part of like the Kurt Russell thing is like everyone's talking about how like Santa should be fat and he's not necessarily fat in the movie. They keep pointing to like a cola ad and it's like that traditional Santa Claus, where he's like roly-poly and got the red suit. And my understanding was that that was sort of a creation of Coca-Cola. Is that true?
Yeah, it's true. It's kind of amazing. What we perceive today, visually as Santa Claus, was the creation of an ad campaign by Coca-Cola that commenced in 1930.
Yeah.
And it was an artist named Michigan-born artist named Haddon Sundblom. Uh-huh. And previously, a caricaturist named Thomas Nast, late in the 19th century, did an illustration of Santa Claus for Harper's Magazine that really, really kind of solidified our notion of Santa as, ruddy cheeked and white bearded and accoutrements all over him, like holly and a kind of a jolly look. Yeah. But it's still very old fashioned, Christian. If you look back on that, it still has that weird old timey look.
Yeah.
What Haddon Sundblom did in 1930 was he was a painter and he was actually a master pinup artist. He used to a master of the feminine form in those days.
Oh.
And he took that Thomas Nast Santa Claus and softened it and put a painterly glow on it. So the Santa Claus you see in those Coca-Cola ads, for many of us, that's the real Santa. Even if we don't really know that it came from a Coca-Cola in the 1930s.
Wow. Yeah, I remember learning that like years and years ago, again, being a lapsed Catholic and just being blown away and saying like, what? Like that's all based off of, and then just the realization of like how much advertising has shaped our culture in a way, like particularly when it comes to Christmas. And that's the funny thing in this movie. The people that keep running into him are like, well, you're not fat enough. And then there's like the soda ads keep coming up, but it's obviously not Coca-Cola because they don't want to tick anybody off. It's just like this generic cola ad. So I figured since I had an expert on the line, I would ask you about it.
Oh yeah. And so much of, Christmas pop culture is tied into marketing.
Yeah.
So for instance, not only the Santa Claus Coca-Cola thing, but Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer itself began life as a mascot for the Montgomery Ward chain of department stores.
Oh.
Montgomery Ward commissioned a poem, and they put out little booklets, which I'm sure would be worth a fortune today if you had one.
Yeah.
And that was very popular. So he began as a mascot. And then one day the poet's brother-in-law, Johnny Marks, a famous composer, set the poem to music. And then, Gene Autry, who was the singing cowboy of the movies, he put it out as a single and it became a number one single briefly. And so, you know, it just built and built and built from there. But if you ever need any proof that Christmas is a lot about marketing, Christmas culture,
then just look at
the Haddon Sundblom Coca-Cola Santa, or the department store icon of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. That I did not know. I mean, I had always thought that it had started with the song. I did not know it was like a commissioned poem for like an ad camp or anything like that, like a mascot for that's crazy.
I know. It's really crazy. And then Frosty, I won't bore you.
Oh no, you're just gonna destroy Christmas tree like altogether. Let's blow it all up.
Well, Frosty, he was on a roll. He being Gene Autry, was on a roll. He's like, hey man, I'm having hit records off of these characters. So they did a Frosty song, and that's where Frosty started. So he wasn't actually a mascot, but he was sort of like a spinoff of a mascot.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So that's crazy. You're blowing my mind. I mean, I knew some of this stuff, like I said, like the Santa Claus stuff, but I did not know like the definitive origin of Rudolph and or Frosty. Like, that's crazy. People are going to accuse us of like starting a war on Christmas or something, but we're not. This is about loving Christmas, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and since you're a fellow lapsed Catholic, I mean, I write about all the, I sort of bookend the Holly Jolly at the beginning and at the very end. I do first person and talk about my memories. And that was the thing, like the nuns that I attended Holy Rosary School in the Diocese of Camden, New Jersey.
And great.
They'd always stress that at first they would say, it's not Christmas, it's Christ's Mass.
Oh,
and
wow.
Yeah.
And they were hardcore.
They were hardcore. Oh, yeah. They had the rulers ready. And it isn't a holiday, it's a holy day. And the one that really blew my mind was they said, abbreviation, Xmas.
Yeah.
And they said, Xmas is a tool of, never use it because it's a tool of godless heathens to cross out, hence the X, the name of Christ.
Oh.
And I had noticed that in my house, all the boxes of Christmas decorations that we got out from the crawl space every year said Xmas on them. So I said to my dad, were you trying to cross out Christ? You know, I'm like in first grade. Were you trying to cross out Christ? And he said, no, it's an abbreviation to save time. So,
Oh, wow. What was his reaction to that? What was the look on his face like when you said that?
Oh, no, he was very matter of fact. He's like a Marine during World War II. So he was, just like, and then when I thought about it as an adult, it's like, yeah, if you're looking at a bunch of boxes and they say Xmas, your eyes go right there.
Yeah.
But it says Christmas, it's like a couple more characters anyway.
Well, no, I mean, my name is Christian. So I understand the pain of like having to write out the whole, and I've had people sometimes call me Chris and it aggravates me because I'm like, no, my name is Christian. But I totally get the wanting to shorten it. And, you know, especially if you've got boxes and boxes of decorations, right?
Yeah.
So caused you to sort of, you know, again, we keep using the term lapsed Catholic, but you're a devout lapsed Catholic. you're even deeper than I ever was, I guess, into the lapse of the religious aspect of it. But what sort of thing, what made you interested in exploring, like deeply going into, you know, like the origins of everything Christmas?
Well, I guess it's when you're looking for like a topic that resonates in the culture, I can't think of any single topic that does so more than Christmas. I mean, there's so many. If you think of all the movies, television shows, books, even cuisine, decor, poetry, stained glass windows. I mean, like anything you can think of, there's so much culture that was built around this single topic. Yeah. I can't think of another one. So I knew it was going to be a rich topic that I'd, you know, never be able to cover at all. Mm-hmm. But, and Christian, I designed the book as well. So, yeah. It was, it's a very visual book and, it's, you know, it's a full color hardback. All those rich images. I mean, all I had to do was get out of their way because, you know, it's like I said, it brings back so many memories to look at a still from a Charlie Brown Christmas or How the Grinch Stole Christmas or Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer or the Honeymooners Christmas episode, whatever it is, the imagery is so provocative.
But I mean, obviously you had your monster book and all that sort of thing. Was it just your sort of, obviously you must celebrate it every year because even being lapsed Catholics, we love the holiday. I mean, I love Christmas. I mean, you know, the time I will admit that sometimes I am a bit of a Scrooge when it starts coming around and I'm like, oh, here it comes again. But then when it hits, you know, I get all warm and fuzzy just like anybody else. Is that the reasoning? Like, but I know for a fact that I could never necessarily pull away from it completely, you know, because of my upbringing. Is that sort of part of it as well?
Well, yeah, in a way. I mean, the great thing about Christmas is that you don't have to be Christian to with a C to love it. I mean, two famous examples, and they're both quoted in Holly Jolly of Jewish celebrities who their favorite holidays were Christmas was Stan Lee, who was the creator of Spider-Man, and Joe Besser, who was the third stooge. He was Jewish, but his favorite holiday was Christmas because why wouldn't it be? I mean, the candy canes and the lights and the rockin' movies and music, you know, because it's not just for Christians. To borrow from the slogan for Levy's real Jewish rye bread, you don't have to be Christian to love Christmas.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's sort of been an interesting thing as I've grown up and moved away from sort of my religious upbringing or what was, I mean, it wasn't like super hardcore like you. No, I mean, I did go to Catholic school up until eighth grade and, you know, went to church every Sunday and all that sort of thing. But as I got older and sort of moved away from that, it sort of became obvious to me that the culture as a whole had embraced it as something else. And I always wondered if people from other religions, I mean, I, to a certain extent, were either felt oppressed by it or overwhelmed by it because it was based in Catholicism, but it's also sort of become something else, right?
Yeah, there is an essay in Holly Jolly called titled "The Two Christmases," yeah. where I do contrast the you know what people call quote unquote the true meaning of Christmas and then what people call I'll also say quote unquote the commercial Christmas. I kind of like to think of it more as the pop culture Christmas because yeah, it's commercial. I mean, you and I were just talking earlier about the Coca-Cola Santa and the department store Rudolph. Yeah, it's commercial, but It also gets you somewhere deep because one thing that those two kinds of Christmases share is at the end of the year with 7 days left on the calendar, you really are kind of looking at yourself and wondering if you were, you know, good enough to your fellow man and you are reaching into your pockets and to drop some paper into the Salvation Army ladies, kettle, and you and or donating toys or clothes, you know, and so it's so it is kind of like heartwarming, and I think necessary to us as human beings to have that moment of self-reflection. And as Dickens wrote, it would be great to make mankind your business all year long.
Yeah.
At least at Christmas time, we do have that little bit of a sobering moment where we consider people who are less well off.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was always sort of, especially because of my upbringing and quite honestly, having been like a kid who was raised on comics and, you know, personally, and anybody who listens to this podcast knows my favorite was always Superman. But the message of Christmas that always came through to me and that always kind of like warmed my heart was the sort of like, you know, the golden rule, right? Or peace on earth, goodwill to men or people, we should say. That was sort of always the thing that I loved about it. And it's funny how that to me has become the message that has come about, you know, as to whether that's based on in my religious upbringing. I mean, I can't say, but that is the message that still comes true to me this day.
Yeah. Like I said, even if you just don't bring baby Jesus into it at all, you're just let's say you're just an atheist or an agnostic or a snake handler, and but you just watch maybe that Honeymooners episode of Christmas episode of the Honeymooners.
Yeah.
And
oh my God, Ralph, you are going back. That's great. Yeah. No, me too. I love that. Go on. Sorry.
Well, Ralph does that little soliloquy about at the end about the spirit of Christmas and how people in Brooklyn walking down the streets are friendlier to each other the closer it gets. And just something like that could like warm your heart. And it really doesn't, have to do with religion. I think it's something that grew out of it and got commercialized and marketed. But
yeah,
I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's interesting. So obviously this is like a gigantic subject to tackle. Where did you start? Like when you're sort of, I mean, obviously there's so much to look into, and you know, looking at the description of the book, there's a lot in here. Like there's interviews and, you know, you delve into everything from like decorations to the songs to, you know, it looks like even Andy Williams has interviews in here. So, I mean, Andy Williams, for anybody who doesn't know that, you know, is younger than us is just, well, how could you not? I mean, come on, if you celebrate Christmas, like his songs come on the radio every year. But I'm just saying, I'm just wondering, you have an idea and you're like, I'm going to write this book about Christmas. Where do you begin?
Yeah, well, no, that's the fun thing. With these hardbacks I've done for Tomorrow's, I know I have 192 pages. So I actually, before I start, I make a page plan. Uh-huh. But I kind of know as a designer what I want to give space to, like what I want to like give, colorful, you know, big graphics to. Yeah. But I make a page plan and then I have to condense certain things. One of my aces in the hole for condensing things is that toward the beginning of the book, there's a 4-page timeline that begins at 4 BC and ends in the 90s and thereafter. Yeah. And every kind of major thing that happened in Christmas culture is covered there. Like, so that you could really, if you only read those 4 pages, you could get a sense of how it built, you know, how, you know, St. Nick was born in 2070 and when the New Testament started to appear and when the ancient carols started coming out, you know, in the 1600s, Christian, we already had so many of the things that we use now to celebrate Christmas were already in place in the 1600s. There was already Christmas carols that we still know now. There were Christmas trees, and there was a version of Santa Claus. Yeah. By the late 19th century, around the time that Dickens published A Christmas Carol, mm-hmm. Everything was in place. It was just a matter of, you know, keeping on contributing to the culture via whatever new formats came up, you know, like movies and television and everything. So that's what I did. I just like stuck to the page plan, and there, you know, it's I think I got it all in there. You know, I don't think anybody would say like, how could you not have Nestor the long-eared donkey?
Oh my God! Wow. We are delving into the obscure. Yeah, I mean, is Nestor something that they, I guess on cable I've seen it, but I think I have it on DVD somewhere.
Yeah, Nestor's really sweet. I mean, he's a later Rankin Bass creation.
Yeah.
And I really only show him and refer to him a couple of times. But what's interesting about Nestor is the Little Drummer Boy, the Rankin Bass special of Little Drummer Boy.
Yeah.
It depicts the first Noel. It depicts you know, baby Jesus in the hay strewn manger with the wise men and everybody. And in Rankin Bass's Little Drummer Boy, the Little Drummer Boy wants his little lamb to come back to life and plays a song for baby Jesus. In Nestor the Long-Eared Donkey, he's also there, you know, during the, so it's very interesting. And it has a Bambi moment. Nestor's mom dies because there's a terrible snowstorm. And so she covers him. And then when the storm's over, he wakes up and she's on top, you know, she's on top of him having protected him, yeah. But she's no longer there. So it had, so what a lesson for the little ones, you know?
Well, you know, there's tragedy in every fairy tale, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
And Christmas is no exception. It's interesting to me. I'm imagining that you sort of had to start exposing yourself to Christmas stuff during a time of year when it wasn't Christmas. I mean, did you go back and watch all these specials? Did you go back and watch all these movies? Were you taking meticulous notes? And then sort of by the time Christmas came around, were you so done with it that you didn't want to have anything to do with it? Or did you just find a new appreciation for the holiday in writing this book?
Well, it's funny you should ask that. I started it pretty much exactly 2 years ago, in early December of 2018. And so my Christmas stuff was up.
Yeah.
And I just thought, well, I'm going to leave, you know, my 1950s silver aluminum Christmas tree. And I just thought, I'm going to leave it up the whole time I'm working on this project.
Really?
To keep myself in the spirit.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm going to get sick of it, but that's what I'm going to do. And it's, you know, here we are 2 years later and I'm not sick of it. In fact, it's going to be really painful in January to finally put away my Christmas, aluminum Christmas tree. But I found out that you can live in that Christmas bubble for 2 years without getting sick of it, you know?
Yeah.
I actually finished the book, shortly before COVID hit. So, there wouldn't be, but there's nothing sort of current events-y that affects it. It's because the whole idea is to try to make it timeless, just as the material that I'm presenting is timeless.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's interesting too, because there's, you know, just looking at the cover of the book, which is beautiful and just like stands out. It's like a big Santa face and like all these like little decorations. And, you know, you've done a great job of designing the cover or whoever put it together, because that's going to stand out. Well, if you're in a bookstore, stand out on the shelves, but
from your lips to God's ears.
Well, you know, but to me, what's funny to me is that no matter sort of what era the decorations or the illustrations come from, they still are sort of timeless, you know, no matter how kitschy or strange looking they might be. If it's Christmas, there's something basic in the design that lasts through time, right?
Yeah, because like I said, reading the Dickens is really instructive, the novella, because, I mean, it was published, I think it came out in December of 1843.
Yeah.
And so as you're reading it, it actually kind of transports you back to Victorian England, and particularly in the vivid description of the room where Scrooge finds the Ghost of Christmas Present. Yeah. It describes all the rockinest Christmas party you can imagine with all these decorations, all this holly, all these sweetmeats and, suckling pigs and just, you know, all this fruit and nuts. And you just think like, wow, this was what it was like before Little Debbie's Christmas tree cakes.
Oh, wow. That's great. That's great. So let me ask you another question, because obviously you've researched a lot of the music. And I remember, well, it's interesting, I should say, about the Dickens A Christmas Carol book. There was one year where I actually sat down with my daughter and we took the month of December. And, you know, when I still used to read to her before bed, she's too old for that now, but I sat down and we read the book together. And I was just blown away by how timeless that book was. You know, I mean, obviously the language is different than the, you know, sort of current novels, but how well it is to how easy it is to understand it, how descriptive it is, how beautifully written it is, and how even that sort of language could translate to a little kid while you were reading it to them. It wasn't too complex. It wasn't, there wasn't anything obscure. Like, she got it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and at the risk of getting another rap on the knuckles from the ruler of a nun, I mean, I believe that Dickens' Christmas Carol, I believe this is blasphemy, Christian.
Oh, here it comes.
I believe it's the greatest Christmas story ever written.
Yeah.
But I mean, some people would say like the New Testament, you know. But
well, you know, to some people, that's not a story, right, Mark?
Yeah. Okay. I'll use the story loophole.
Yeah. There we go. We got you out of it.
But Dickens was a champion of you know, what they always refer to as the lower classes,
mm-hmm.
And so he created this character Scrooge, who abhorred poor people and just wanted money.
Sounds familiar.
I was going to say it's very modern, because it unfortunately the need to help those less fortunate is still very much part of our existence.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I was going to ask about before I jumped into the Christmas Carol thing is Christmas carols. Now I'm a big fan of like Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis and Mel Torme, and I like jazz and all that stuff. I was raised on the East Coast like you, in New Jersey and New York. So I was exposed to, and my mother loved like Frank Sinatra, Barbara Streisand, like all that stuff. So obviously I was exposed to that stuff growing up, like in the 80s and the 70s. And so I had a big love for that sort of thing. But one of the things that my daughter, when she was younger, when we started playing, obviously Christmas carols and, you know, again, a love of Frank Sinatra and that sort of music, when she got exposed to jazz and Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr., one of her first things was, the very first thing that she said was, oh, this sounds like Christmas carols. Like, this sounds like Christmas music. Now, can you speak to that too? Because there's a lot, obviously there's modern day sort of more, you know, hip, maybe Christmas music that's been produced since then. But there is sort of like a basic formula, right, for the Christmas carols that maybe you and I grew up on, right?
Yeah, and it's amazing that your daughter had that reaction, because what I've always believed is that, and you said you're a jazz guy, mm-hmm. I'm really not. I like it when I hear it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the Vince Guaraldi trio,
yeah,
that played all that amazing music for Charlie Brown Christmas.
Yeah.
What I fervently believe is that that Christmas special turned generations of children into jazz fans, because
sure,
every one of those songs was played with three acoustic instruments, no amplification. It was Vince on the piano, it was an upright bass, and it was brushes on a drum. And it just sounds so intimate the way it's recorded.
Yeah.
And it is jazz. Even though the Lucy and Linus theme and Oh Christmas Tree, you know, we just think of Christmas when we hear them. But when you really listen to what those guys are doing, they're playing jazz, you know?
Yeah.
So for the rest of my life, I had the same reaction your daughter had. If I heard like a trio where the pianist was a virtuoso like Vince Guaraldi, and I'd be, it would like remind me of that Charlie Brown Christmas special, and I'd feel a warm feeling. So yeah. I really do believe that, you know, generations of children became jazz fans.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a really good point. I mean, my daughter gets sick of me listening to jazz sometimes, but let me tell you, when you're stuck on the LA freeways and you need something to calm you down, jazz is probably the best thing. But it's interesting to me, though, that there a lot of the stuff that we still cling to as Christmas music today was probably written in what, the 30s, 40s, 50s, right?
Well, sure. The most famous example, I think, is in 1941 on Christmas Day, Bing Crosby sang Irving Berlin's brand new composition, White Christmas, on the radio. Yeah. And so this was weeks after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Oh. So thousands of young Americans were enlisting and thinking about, they were spending maybe their first Christmas of their lives away from home. And the lyrics that Irving Berlin wrote, I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, like just like the ones I used to know.
Yeah.
That's why the song resonated so much in wartime, because these guys were who knows where, and they were dreaming of being home for Christmas. So that, and Bing's vocals are so smooth.
Yeah.
And that song is actually still, to this day, the number one best-selling song. I'm surprised something hasn't knocked it off since. But
really?
It still stands as the number one selling song, is White Christmas.
Is it just the song, or is it the Bing Crosby version?
You got me there. I'd have to look that one up.
Yeah,
but I do think it is the Bing one.
Oh,
because,
wow.
But of course, a lot of people covered it, and a lot of people covered, so many of the Christmas songs. I mean, that's the fun thing about it. And yeah. And I never knew until I was working on the book that you mentioned Sinatra a couple of times, but that Sinatra actually co-wrote Mistletoe and Holly. That's pretty cool.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I didn't know that. It's like, oh, wow, he co-wrote it, because that song is cool. My favorite is, if you've ever heard it from 1959, Dean Martin doing Let It Snow.
Oh, yeah.
Because he sounds like he's had his third drink. And he's just, the weather. and the arrangement is sort of like Doris Day.
Yeah.
It's like really like old-fashioned, goofy.
Yeah.
And but he's flawless. He's, he sings it. When he sings it, it's like it doesn't hurt him,
So. Well, the thing about Dean Martin that I always love, and I think that why he became so, is that he just seemed like he was having fun all the time when he was singing. There didn't seem to be any sort of pretense to him. There didn't seem to be any sort of like, I'm trying to make this deeper than it actually is. He's like, we're having fun. We're at a party, whether it was a Christmas party or, a regular party, and we're all drinking and having fun, right?
Oh, yeah. I think that's he's so lovable in the movies and, and then that series he did. I mean, like we grew up watching that, the hour long variety show, the Dean Martin.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, and he and Frank did Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
Well, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
They did a Christmas special in the mid 60s, and it's really something to see. The entire thing's on YouTube.
Oh,
it's
I gotta check it out.
Called like Dean and Frank's Family Christmas, and they have all their kids on. And that's an amazing thing about sort of the Rat Packers is that, Dean Martin's son was in Dino, Desi, and Billy.
Yeah.
Frank Sinatra's daughter was Nancy Sinatra, who had that awesome song Boots.
Yeah.
And even Jerry Lewis, who was on the periphery, his son was Gary Lewis, who had, this diamond ring. So all these, the offspring of all these kind of like 40s, 50s guys were having hits in the 60s.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. No, that's great. So while we're talking about like the 60s and stuff like that, I mean, I do want to ask you about, because you've got interviews in here with Andy Williams and Darlene Love, which what did you learn about Andy Williams? Because I'm just wondering, because to me, and probably people, from our sort of generation, like you hear that come on and, sometimes it's a funny joke. It's like it's the whitest thing you've ever heard. But at the same time, it's like his stuff is gorgeous. And I can't go through a holiday without either being exposed or bringing him up. you know, to listen to. So what did you learn anything interesting about Andy Williams himself? Like, and I see like in the text that Tomorrow sent, he's like, quote, known as Mr. Christmas. So can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, TV's Mr. Christmas. Yeah. That one song, Most Wonderful Time of the Year.
Yeah.
By Andy Williams in particular, that thing swings, you know, you talk about guys, that is a swinging song, you know, the interesting thing is, not every celebrity who was associated with Christmas was kind of a fanatic, but he was kind of a fanatic about it. Mm. And, the reason that they called him TV's Mr. Christmas was that, he had a variety show.
Yeah.
And, you remember it growing up, probably.
Oh, I remember. Yeah.
But for Christmas one year, it wasn't even the first season, but one year he just had his family on. Now his family included, he had three brothers who kind of looked like him, and they were a quartet. Oh, I'm sorry. I'll say two or three, because I'm blanking out whether it was two or three.
Yeah.
I think there were four Williams brothers.
There were a lot of them.
Yeah. But, it wasn't King family level, but they, they were a vocal group, you know, beginning in the 40s. And, so he would have them on, and, so they were pros, and then he'd have his family on, and, he even had his parents on.
Yeah.
And they had so much fun doing it, and they got so much good response to it that they made it an annual tradition.
Yeah.
So there for the next, I don't know, 8 or 9 years that he had the show on, he always had a really special Christmas episode. And he said, you know, for instance, he said Warren Beatty, ran into him once and said like, "Hey man, I love those Christmas shows you guys do."
Oh,
so,
wow.
You know, so it resonated, but yeah, he loved Christmas. You know, in the interview, he reminisces about, you know, growing up and going from house to house, singing carols and, you know, getting hot chocolate and all that bucolic stuff.
Oh, wow. That's great. What about, Darlene Love? Because that to me is, I mean, it's a great song and it plays every year, and I guess it just wouldn't have been the thing that popped up into my head. But when I read, you know, the email that Tomorrow sent, I was like, yeah, how is that? Like, and to you, obviously it stood out as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a great record, and the entire record too, if you can ever get a hold of it, it's a Phil Spector Christmas. It has like all these artists on it, that he produced. You know, we'll put aside the fact that he was a wackadoo for
an awful human being,
it wouldn't be Christmas without hearing that, and you know what pipes she still has to this day.
Yeah.
In the interview, she, just like I do with Andy Williams, she reminisces about, singing. She said they were a poor family, but they didn't know it, you know?
Yeah.
And, suddenly at Christmas time, they had more, and it was magical how the tree would be there on Christmas morning that wasn't there on the night of Christmas Eve. And, she talks about, you know, singing in church, singing in the church choir, which is of course where a lot of artists of her generation, you know, first sang. The classic is either in church or on street corners. Like the doo-wop people would be on street corners, you know. So she is somebody who just loves it, and she really loves the, she's very Christian. She's a devout Christian. So
she
says, you know, so yeah, no, she was fun. And I spoke with, Charles Schulz too.
That's amazing. No, continue. I want to hear this, but.
Oh, sure. Well, the way it happened was, I spent my career as a, entertainment reporter for newspapers.
Yeah.
And I honed a specialty for interviews. I became an interview hound. So anybody who created the culture that I grew up with, I went after them if I could.
Yeah.
So I got a lot of, you know, really cool people. And, a lot of those interviews are in, you know, Groovy and Monster Mash if they're pertinent to the topic. So, one time it was the 50th anniversary of Peanuts. And I got Charles M. Scholes on the phone, and honestly, mostly we spoke about at my urging, we spoke about that Christmas special because that's such an interesting story because they were heartbroken when they started seeing the animation coming back.
Oh, really?
Because, they thought the deadline was really tight.
Yeah.
And because it was done for a corporate client, I might have been Coke, but it was done for a corporate client out of the blue. So they were farming it out to even more than one animator. So the animation isn't consistent, and it is kind of rocky, and some slapsticky things happen in it that never happened in the Peanut strip, like when Snoopy has a blanket full of ice skaters and he throws them in all directions. And if you notice, the Charlie Brown tree looks different sometimes from frame to frame, you know.
Oh, sure.
So they thought, oh my God, this is a disaster, and they believed that the only reason it even aired, because the client didn't like it either, was because it was so late, it was too late to pull it. And Christian, that special got an Emmy, and as you know, since it first aired in 1965, it is aired every single year, and it is so charming. And you look at it now and you say, what, you know, we grew up with it, but what was the problem? This thing is amazing. You know,
it was
the first special to talk about kind of like, you know, depressing topics like Charlie Brown can't get happy even though it's Christmas. And also the Vince Guaraldi score. And then also finally, when Linus, in answer to the question, what is the true meaning of Christmas, on the rehearsal stage there, he stands up and recites that passage from Luke 2, and which was really unheard of in those days because separation of church and state.
Yeah.
But they pushed it through, and it works like a charm.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it's immortal. And then everyone this year was like freaking out, right? Because it might not have been broadcast on TV because I think Apple bought the rights or something.
Oh, I didn't follow that drama.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I can't imagine anybody censoring that thing now. I mean, like it's just too perfect and too embedded, you know?
Yeah. No, it wasn't that they were censoring it. I think that they had bought the rights or purchased the rights. Maybe it was Apple. Maybe it was somebody. I mean, I wasn't following it, you know, I wasn't following the story, but there's a lot of, I mean, it would just pop up in my Facebook feed every once in a while or, you know, my Google news alerts, but apparently it wasn't going to air on like regular TV this year, that or The Great Pumpkin. And people got like really upset. So I think that Apple is lending it to PBS so that they can play it like on regular TV. But, you know, we're sort of in this streaming era. And now it's like if you don't have something, which is why, you know, and I've said this on my podcast several times, I'm still addicted to physical media because I'm like, you will not take my Charlie Brown Christmas away, you know, my ability to access it without having to pay you, you know, a subscription fee. Maybe I'm just old fashioned that way. So yeah, that was sort of a thing that had started going down that people were getting really upset about.
And that kind of brings us back to Dickens and the haves and the haves not. Because if people of means are the only ones who can watch a Charlie Brown Christmas because they can pay the subscription fee.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
But I'm glad
there was pushback and I'm glad that there was a correction.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. And it's funny because, I mean, it'll be on PBS, which hopefully will expose people to other enlightening topics as well. You know, so I don't. Yeah. I'm the California liberal. Sorry. You know, I personally, I mean, that's just always been, we've been a stalwart part of Christmas, the Christmas season, you know, the Charlie Brown thing, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Frosty the Snowman. And it's funny how the origins of all that developed and how people getting exposed to it have changed over the years. I mean, it's funny because now it gets me thinking, part of what's made Christmas so popular has also been the accessibility of these specials, right? The fact that they've been out there and you knew when they were coming and you would run to the TV and everyone could watch them, correct?
Yeah. And I think the golden period was three years in a row. Mm-hmm. 1964 brought us Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Yeah.
65 brought us Charlie Brown Christmas. And in 1966, it was How the Grinch Stole Christmas. And those three, I think, are the best of all the specials. And it just imagine like in that 3 year period, three consecutive years to bring those things out. And they resonate to this day.
Yeah, for sure. It's funny because over Thanksgiving holiday, like right before or after, it's vacation, so we were watching some Christmas specials, and one of the new Pixar ones, we saw Prep and Landing, we were watching, and we were talking about how much we like loved it, and like it was kind of like a new classic. And my wife said something to the effect of like, oh, well, my favorites are from the 70s, you know, and obviously you said they were from the 60s, but we saw them in the 70s. So and my daughter goes, oh, you mean like It's a Wonderful Life? You're just like, oh my God, no. It was a really cute sort of like holiday moment, but where we were just like, wow, these things have just to kids, they've just become sort of immortalized. They all happened in the same time, and they're all, you know, even A Christmas Story, right? It's, we get exposed to them at the same time of year, so we sort of associate them with one another, even though they were made at different times, you know, in the 20th century, right?
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's very sweet, you know, because they all are kind of doing the same job of, you know, warming our hearts. And, A Christmas Story, of course, looks older than it is. It came out in, 81 or 82.
Yeah.
And, but it's set vaguely in the 40s. So it has that kind of look and sensibility of nostalgia.
Yeah. So let me ask you a couple of final questions, because I've almost had you on for an hour and I don't want to steal your Sunday. But what was the most surprising thing that you discovered while researching this book? I don't know if you've ever heard of a TV show called like Adam Ruins Everything, but they did an episode on Christmas. And the basic premise is that there's this guy named Adam, right? And he ruins everyone's day with like facts, you know, the show, and it's to educate you on like the real origins of stuff. And there was they did an episode, Adam Ruins Christmas, which is, to me, was hysterical, because it was just like, oh my God, they just broke everything down. And, you know, the real origins, or, you know, quote unquote, real origins of like things that developed and created the Christmas holiday. But so to you, while researching this book, was there anything that just blew your mind where you were just like, oh my God, that I did not know this, or this is terrible, or this is wonderful? Or did you have any sort of reactions to that while you were researching the book?
Yeah, I think the one that really surprised me, and it's kind of weird, is the evolution of Santa Claus. Mm-hmm. And in particular, like, even back to when he was Saint Nick, you know, he was, Saint Nicholas was not Santa Claus. He, you know, wasn't, you know, fat, didn't have a beard, but the one thing he shared is he committed random acts of philanthropy, anonymously and under cloak of darkness, which sounds very much like Santa Claus, you know. there's one story where he on three consecutive nights, he tossed bags of gold into the home of a villager who was so destitute that he was on the verge of selling his daughters into prostitution.
Oh no!
But then they have like as his legend grew, like long after his death. They started having weirder stories about Saint Nick, and one of those is that one day during a shortage of meat, a butcher murdered three children and then pickled them in brine and sold them as pork, and somehow Saint Nick resurrected those children. So that's like a horror movie.
Holy cow.
It's like a Stephen King novel. So I don't even have a title for it, The Pickled Children. But so they started just ascribing these like wild legends to him. And then And then the character kind of broke, like I say, broke away into Santa Claus and even Father Christmas a little in there, you know. So, yeah, that was the weirdest thing. But one of the things that I'd already known about that I'm kind of trying to hep the world to in Holly Jolly is there are these two movies that are not considered classics at all that I give generous space to. One, I'll say it real quick. One is a movie titled Santa Claus, 1959 from Mexico. Christian, it's the weirdest movie you've ever seen.
Oh,
Santa
wow.
Claus fights the devil. And it's bizarre. There's a lot of like lost in translation weirdnesses, but it's so charming. But you watch it and you say like, what is this? Is this like a Disney movie on acid?
And then where did you find this? Like, where can you see it?
Actually, it is on the YouTube. Yeah, you can find it on YouTube. Oh, just wow. Type in Santa Claus 1959, and I think it'll show up. It's really worth a spin. And then another one is a little more famous. It's Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
Yeah.
And people just think, oh, that's just a terrible, you know, sci-fi movie. But actually, it's a little hipper than that. It's really funny. Yeah, it's low budget. You know, Pia Zadora plays a Martian child in it, famously. But those two movies, I'm hoping, you know, someday that they will get the recognition they deserve.
That's so funny. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned sort of like horror things, because we've had like in the past several years, and I'm a horror fan, but we've had in the last several years like Krampus movies popping up and like weird like horror movies set during the holiday season, which my wife will not watch with me like at all. But like one of the classics is like Black Christmas, you know, which I still consider to be really creepy and scary. Obviously, I don't expect you to have devoted any part of your Christmas book to that. But can you speak to that, since you sort of, I mean, it seems like some of the roots of Santa Claus are, you know, based on like really terrible things happening to, you know, the disenfranchised, right?
Yeah, and that would make an interesting horror film, you know.
Yeah.
But no, I haven't seen any of the Krampus movies, but I know what you're talking about. I did see there's one in the 80s. I can't think of the title of it, where Santa Claus is an axe murderer.
Yeah, Silent Night, Deadly Night. Yeah.
Silent Night, Deadly One. Yeah. Deadly Night. And interestingly, the woman who plays the Mother Superior in that is a French actress. I can't think of her name, but she was like renowned as an acting teacher in Hollywood.
Uh-huh.
And here she is putting on this habit and acting all like evil.
Yeah.
But it's a bloody movie, and Linnea Quigley gets she gets the murderous Santa Claus lifts her up and impales her on the antlers of a reindeer head that's on the wall.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, no, sure. That's fun. I don't think I did any of that.
No, that's good that you, I mean,
I kept it family friendly, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And I didn't mean to necessarily bring it up towards the end of our interview and make it sort of like a down, but that's so funny that, yeah, Silent Night, Deadly Night. I think I watched that. I hadn't seen it in years. And you mentioned the Leanna Quigley thing, and I was just like, what? This is bonkers. I guess I didn't remember it or blocked it out of my memory because I hadn't seen it since I was like maybe a teenager and forgotten about it. But yeah, that's a crazy movie. But let's not end on that. Let's end on like, what was sort of the most heartwarming thing that you discovered or that you felt like while reading this book? Because I know that for me, and I mentioned it earlier, like Christmas comes around and all my friends and coworkers or whatever, people who are exposed to me, I get like really grumpy and I'm like, blah, blah, blah. But like I said, like by the time, you know, it rolls around, I'm sort of like the Grinch. It's like my heart has swollen two sizes too large for my chest. And I really enjoy it when it gets here, you know, but it's the buildup to it that sort of like brings me down a bit. And I, you know, I don't know why. But I love Christmas. I mean, I will say I love Christmas. What was sort of the most, I guess, heartwarming thing that you discovered while you were researching this book or reading it or that just made you appreciate the holiday more than you did?
Well, I think Christian, it's something that we did discuss earlier about the common theme through so much of Christmas culture about the possibility of redemption and the need to sort of give to people who are less fortunate than you. It's in nearly all of them. Old Man Potter from It's a Wonderful Life is the only Scrooge surrogate that actually doesn't get redeemed. His last line in the film is "Merry Christmas to you in jail." You know.
Yeah.
And we never revisit him. He never goes like, hey, he doesn't show up at the party at the end of Jimmy Stewart's party and take off his rings and drop them, you know, but, or give back that 800 bucks that he stole from Uncle Billy.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Right.
Yeah. But that's the thing, you know, like in all of them in Miracle, on 34th Street, you know, he's, it's almost like he's trying to convert Natalie Wood, who's, you know, playing the little girl, and Maureen O'Hara, who's playing her mother, into believing in Santa Claus, because he thinks that that magical childlike idea of believing in something, even though your brain tells you it doesn't make sense, you know, which is, you know, a paraphrase from the movie, that there's value in that, and that it helps you, it helps people around you. So yeah, I think that common thread of charity and no reason to only practice it one day a year. There's 364 other days, you know?
Yeah. No, that's great. And so, final question, what is your favorite Christmas special or holiday pop culture thing? Like, what is the absolute number one thing that you cannot skip every year?
That one's easy, Christian. It's the 1951 Scrooge, starring Alistair Sim as Ebenezer Scrooge. It's a perfect movie. The cast is amazing. Mm-hmm. It borrows so much from Dickens. I started with that movie as a child. It was on our PBS station in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. Channel 12, every Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
So I really tied everything into that, like my whole, you know, psych for the holiday. And when I finally did read the Dickens, I couldn't believe how much, verse was lifted right from the Dickens. But when they deviate, which they do on occasion, it always seems to be that they're not taking liberties. They're actually doing like some logical and appropriate and even Dickensian additions to the story, you know. Yeah. There was a quote that old Fezziwig, who was young Ebenezer's boss, always said in the movie, that I thought for sure had to be written by Charles Dickens. And he was saying, it's not for money alone that one spends a lifetime building up a business. And he says, I will die out with the old ways. I'm sorry. He says, I will cling to the old ways and die out with them if needs must. And I thought, wow, that Dickens, what a writer. And then and I found out it wasn't him, you know.
Oh, wow. That's great. Well, you know, I must say, this conversation and, you know, just the basic design of the cover have made me want to pick this book up. So, and I love Tomorrow's. I love everything that they do. I wish I could buy everything that they do, but I can't. But this definitely is something that I think I'm going to pick up, just, you know, to pull out with the Christmas decorations and have on the coffee table for anyone to peruse through. I mean, it sounds like a wonderful book. Is there anything final that you would like to say about it, Mark?
Oh, the slogan for 2020 here is, we can only use it this year, make Christmas merry again.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you mentioned Tomorrow's, because it would be remiss of me not to share with your listeners how they can get it. It's Tomorrow's.com, Tomorrow's.com has it. But it's wherever books are sold online. It's also on BarnesandNoble.com and Amazon and Target and Walmart. And I had a blast talking with you, Christian, and I really do feel like tearing open a box of Little Debbie's Christmas tree cakes right now.
As do we all, although I'm gluten-free. Can you get more Californian than that? No, I don't think so. Well, thank you, Mark. I really appreciate your time, and I appreciate you dealing with the Skype, the nightmare that Skype can be sometimes. So I appreciate you just, you know, coming on. And like I said, I love all of Tomorrow's stuff, and this book sounds like a blast.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, I'll say it again. Thank you, Christian. I had a blast hanging out with you.
Cool. Well, again, the book is called Holly Jolly, Celebrating Christmas Past in Pop Culture. And the author, who I've had on the line, is Mark Voger.
Oh, it's a hard G, but it doesn't matter.
Voger. Mark, yeah, Voger. Yeah. No, it matters to me. I got to get it right. And yeah, I probably screwed it up several times already. So it's Mark Voger, correct?
Yeah, but I do love your French pronunciation, Marcel Vogier.
Well, you came up with the Marcel. That's your alias from now on. You can write a book about Paris and use that.
Oh, yeah. Boy, that'd be a short book.
Well, anyway, it's Mark Voger, and the book is Holly Jolly, Celebrating Christmas Past in Pop Culture. And you can get it by Tomorrow's Publishing at tomorrows.com. And again, wherever, you know, you can buy books online. And it sounds wonderful. I can't wait to get my hands on it. And my name, again, is Christian Horn. And this has been the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that wonderful social media stuff. And our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Again, thank you for listening. And we will be back soon with another episode. Make sure to pick up this book. It's perfect for the holiday season. Bye.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing. I'm doing part-time fanboy.